thank you for joining us.
Hey, my pleasure.
Hey, Lee, as a legally trained journalist, I know that you spent a few years trying to disprove Christianity. At the start, how certain were you that you would be successful at doing that?
Well, you know, I started out with kind of mixed motives. I was living a very immoral lifestyle, and so I sure didn't want there to be a God. I had reasons for not finding God and reasons for not concluding that Jesus is who he claimed to be. On the other hand, having been trained as a journalist and in law, I really wanted to kind of adopt the posture of an umpire in a baseball game and say, you know what, regardless of what the outcome means for me, I'm going to try to call a ball and a strike, and I'm just going to try to honestly evaluate the evidence and let it lead me wherever it will, even, you know, if it's to a very uncomfortable conclusion that God exists.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of the approach I took, and, you know, I went into it with a lot of skepticism, with a lot of doubts, and honestly, as I began to investigate other world religions, you know, it was amazing how easy it was to really poke holes in them. But the more I investigated Christianity, the more it really stood up to scrutiny.
Mm. And Lee, one of the things I noticed about your book is that's how you approach the writing. You did it investigatively, very different from most apologetic books.
Yeah, I tried to really kind of take the reader along with me as I sort of retraced and expanded upon my original investigation. And instead of me just sort of repeating back the evidence, I interviewed scholars and experts and tried to pose to them the tough questions I had when I was a skeptic and leave it up to the reader whether or not they agree that the scholars gave adequate answers.
So, Lee, was there one major area that began to convince you that the claims of Christ were true? In other words, was it the prophecies of Christ, miracles, testimonies of other people? What was it exactly?
Yeah, I mean, it was all those things, for sure. But the number one area was the resurrection of Jesus.
Hmm.
You know, anybody can claim to be the Son of God. And certainly, I think historically, it's pretty undeniable that Jesus made, you know, incredible claims about himself and his being the Messiah and being the unique Son of God. Anybody can claim it, but if you can actually return from the dead, that's pretty good evidence you're telling the truth. So I really saw, as Paul did, you know, Paul says, you know, if the resurrection isn't true, cash it in. You know, you might as well forget the faith because everything hinges on whether it's whether Jesus really did overcome the grave. And as I looked at that, I just saw, you know, first of all, you know, the evidence for his execution is overwhelming. There's not only multiple accounts of that in the New Testament, but there's five ancient accounts outside the Bible that say that Jesus was executed. So we knew he was dead. We have early accounts of his resurrection that are so early that they cannot be legend. We have an empty tomb that even the critics of Jesus admitted was empty. The question wasn't whether it was empty, but how did it get empty? And then we have eyewitnesses, you know, over 515 individuals who encountered the resurrected Jesus, and many of whom's lives were changed 180 degrees against their theological beliefs. They became convinced that Jesus did return from the dead and thus establish his divinity. So it really was the resurrection that I found to be the most compelling evidence that Jesus is really who he claimed to be.
And you're not the first one to say that, are you, Lee? There have been others who have found precisely the same evidence for the resurrection was the tipping point.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, one of my favorite stories involves one of the guys, when I was in law school, I would read about this guy, and he was kind of my hero. He was the greatest lawyer who ever lived. His name is Sir Lionel Luckhoo. He won 248 murder trials in a row as a defense attorney.
Wow.
Nobody has ever been able to. I mean, this guy was, and I admired him because he was such a, he knew what evidence was. He knew how to poke holes in cases. He was just brilliant. And he was an atheist until he was challenged to investigate the evidence for the resurrection. And he did what I did for about 2 years. He concluded that the resurrection was true. And based on that, he became a follower of Jesus. And in his words, my life changed 180 degrees for the good.
Hmm.
So, you know, yeah, you've got lots of people through history who have investigated this themselves and come to the conclusion that the resurrection is not mythology, it's not legendary, it's not wishful thinking. it's an actual historical event for which we have excellent evidence.
Well, Lee, I know that with what you've written and where you've spoken, you've been asked a lot of tough questions about the Christian faith. What was the toughest question you've ever been asked?
Well, I think the number one question in terms of an objection to Christianity is the question of how can a loving God allow pain and suffering in the world? I once commissioned a national study in which I asked a cross-section of Americans, if you could ask God any one question and you knew he'd give you an answer, what would you ask him? And by far, this was the number one question. And, you know, it's a question that some people ask out of their own personal pain, and therefore you can give them, I think Christianity has a good answer for this, but you know, that's not what they're looking for. People who themselves are in the midst of suffering, they really need the presence of Jesus. They need someone to be Jesus to them. They need the love and the grace and someone to enfold them and not just lecture to them. But a lot of people raise it as an intellectual objection. And I just, first of all, I think there is so much evidence. If you have a scales, you know, you talk about law, you know, the scales of justice. On one side, you've got at least 20 categories of evidence that point powerfully toward the truth of Christianity. And that weighs down the scales quite a bit. On the other side of the scales, the biggest objection, really, is the pain and suffering thing. Okay, let's put it into perspective here. Where does the evidence overwhelmingly point us toward the truth of Christianity? And I think the Christian worldview has an explanation for why there's pain in the world. You know, God, you know, wanted to create people who were able to love each other and to love him, just as love existed from eternity past in the Godhead. And in order for love to be expressed, in order for us to experience it, the greatest value in the universe, then we must have free choice. And to have free choice means that we can abuse that free choice and open the door to evil and hurting each other and so forth. And so I think, you know, I think the Christian worldview does have a good explanation for it. In fact, I just did a film that's coming out this month called The Case for Faith, based on my book, The Case for Faith, which deals extensively with this issue of pain and suffering, because I think it really is a significant issue, but it fails to, you know, undermine the overwhelming amount of evidence for the truth of Christianity.
And when can we expect that film?
That's available now, and Lionsgate is distributing it. It's available just about anywhere, and I'm really thrilled with it. The guys who produced it just did a terrific job. We've got Johnny Erickson Tada in it, who tells her story. We have the story of a friend of mine, Mark Herringer, who was involved in the accidental killing of his infant, his toddler daughter. Horrible thing for parents to through an accident,
yes.
Resulting in the death of their daughter, and how that pain and suffering he went through, how God redeemed that in many ways, and how he coped with that. So we have real-life stories, and then we bring in experts, theologians and others, who I think really do a powerful job of giving answers to satisfy our heart and soul.
And Lee, you have a website. I just want to get that out before I even ask any more questions.
Sure.
What is that?
Yeah, it's leestrobel.com, LeeStrobel.com, and we've got a reservoir there of hundreds of free video clips. Everything's free, where you can go in there and you can type in a question about the resurrection or Islam or whatever, and boom, up will come a variety of free video clips that you can watch. And we have experts from all over the country who are participating in that. And I just want it to be a resource that Christians can use to strengthen their faith and spiritual seekers can use to find God.
So I want to ask you about another website since I brought up yours. We found a website called Friendly Atheists.
Oh, right.
Where people can leave questions about Christianity and you make a comment. Do you find, in your experience, that atheists are willing to talk about or examine the facts of the faith?
Well, some are. You know, it's funny. I've been attacked viciously by some atheists, some fantasizing online about murdering me. I've had atheist professors just lie about me in classrooms to the point where I've actually called them up and challenged them. And yet, there are lots who are open. And, you know, this particular website, Friendly Atheist, is run by a guy named Hemant Mehta, who wrote the book, I Sold My Soul on eBay. You may remember
that.
Yes,
sure, yeah.
Went on eBay and supposedly sold his soul. And he's becoming a friend of mine. What he did is he asked his atheist audience, what questions would you ask Lee Strobel? And he said, would you answer these questions? I said, sure, I'd love to. So he sent me this list of questions, probably about 50 of them. And I was a little hesitant because I thought they were going to be kind of gotcha questions, you know, just not really looking for answers, but more trying to be attack dog kind of questions. But they weren't. They were really sincere, honest, searching questions. And so I'm in the process of just sending him answers to those. And he and I are going to, we've already made plans to get together, and who knows what will become of it. But I do find that there are some who are open. And the key is, are you open to the supernatural? Are you open to the idea that that God could even exist? So many atheists rule out the possibility of God at the outset because, that's nothing we can measure in a scientific test tube. Mm. And so they rule them out at the beginning. But those that are open and say, look, I'm going to go wherever the evidence takes me, those are the ones that, many times find the evidence for Jesus being overwhelming. In fact, I interviewed, and I have this on my website, it was fascinating, the number one atheist in the world, Anthony Flew,
yes,
who as you know, wrote many books, including The Presumption of Atheism, was a professor at major universities around Europe, and who a few years ago announced to the world that he was wrong.
That's right.
And I interview him on my website, and I asked him, I said, Dr. Flew, you're the greatest atheist in the world, and now you've renounced a lifetime of atheistic scholarship, and you concluded that God exists. There is a supernatural creator. I said, what was it that convinced you? And he said, number one was the integrated complexity of the biological world.
Yes.
Which is fascinating. But the other thing he said to me that was so important, he said, Lee, I had to follow the evidence wherever it took me.
Now, Lee, wasn't it the DNA that got his attention to do that?
Yeah, I mean, it was the whole idea of the biological world being so integrated with itself, like examples would be DNA, that it cannot be explained away by saying it somehow by accident developed over the eons. And, I did a book called The Case for a Creator, which looks at the scientific evidence for God. And I agree with them that, over the last 50 years, we've had a variety of discoveries in cosmology, physics, astronomy, biology, DNA, human consciousness, and so forth, that really paint a powerful case for the existence of a creator who just coincidentally happens to match a description of the God of the Bible.
Okay, so I want to just to segue a little bit, and I'm going to ask you to give me a state of the union. And what I mean by that is what, in your experience, especially of late, what's the state of the church, the state of truth in the church? How, in other words, do you find the church defending Scripture adequately?
Well, I think we're seeing a resurgence of Christian apologetics. Apologetics, of course, meaning the defense of the faith, the evidence for the truth of what we believe. And it's in response to the atheists who published all of these very ugly books in recent years attacking Christianity, Christopher Hitchens and Richard Dawkins and others. And it's caused a lot of Christians to say, they're raising all these issues. Are there good answers? I'm sure there are, but I don't know what they are. And they've kind of put pressure on the local church to say, hey, my neighbors are asking me these questions because they're reading these books by these atheists. And I'm reading some of the stuff, and I'm having questions. What do we do about this? And so churches have started to really emphasize the evidence for the faith. We're seeing a resurgence of this. I'm seeing it among young people. I just spoke to a conference of 2,000 teenagers who came to spend a weekend to talk about the evidence for the Christian faith.
My.
We're seeing it in the National Apologetics Convention in Charlotte that's held every November. They've had to go to a 4,000-seat venue for it now.
Huh.
And you see universities like Biola University and Southern Evangelical Seminary and other places that are known for this that are just bursting at the seams. So I'm very optimistic, Skip, that we're going to enter into a golden age of Christian apologetics.
Hmm.
And it's thanks to these atheists who tried to shoot down the faith. They just sort of kicked this sleeping giant of the church.
Huh.
And now the church is waking up. I think that's a very good thing.
Great perspective. I recall the era in which guys like Josh McDowell could go on campuses and freely talk about the Bible and Jesus Christ. How open are college campuses in our country now?
Well, I think on one level, they're very open. I went to my old alma mater, the University of Missouri, where I got my journalism degree many years ago, last year, and we held an event in the field house on a weeknight and had 2,000 students show up. So I was thrilled by that. Where I think you're seeing not a lot of openness is among certain professors. You know, if you look at the percentage of professors in American universities who are atheists and who are skeptical about the truth of Scripture, it's far higher percentage than in the population as a whole. So that's a challenge. I think a lot of those guys really try to defend their atheism and skepticism rather than be open to the evidence. But I think among the students, I think they're curious. And you know what's really cool, Skip? One of the great emerging apologists right now is Sean McDowell, Josh's son.
Yes, I know him. I worked with him a couple times, and I've corresponded with him. Great guy.
He's terrific. And you know, I just think that's so cool. In fact, the funny thing is I had never met Josh. I, of course, read his books many times. And when my son went to seminary, he was there with Ryan Dobson and Sean McDowell, and they all became friends. And so that's how I met Josh originally. It was through my son's relationship with Sean.
Wow.
So I think it's so cool that these young people are taking the baton and presenting the evidence in a way that, that appeals and is understandable by a new generation.
Hmm. Lee, you've got a master's degree from Yale Law School. So with your background and your experience broadcasting, et cetera, what's your perspective on this whole fairness doctrine discussion in American broadcasting?
Well, I just am totally against the idea of reinstituting the fairness doctrine. And the reason is, legally speaking, ironically, this is what I studied in law school. My expertise was in the area of First Amendment law. I studied under Floyd Abrams, who was one of the great First Amendment lawyers in the world, and taught First Amendment law at Roosevelt University and so forth. So I have an interest in this particular topic. And, you know, when the Fairness Doctrine was originally instituted, there were a limited number of information outlets in America. You know, you only had the networks on TV and a few AM radio and so forth. Now there is a proliferation of internet and radio and television cable with hundreds of channels. We don't have the same need for a fairness doctrine today that we once may have had. We can allow these various voices to be heard. You know, the idea that the Supreme Court talks about is a marketplace of ideas. We ought to let everybody have their say in the marketplace of ideas. Let them all express their opinions and their viewpoints and present their case so that, in the end, truth will prevail. And when we artificially inhibit that marketplace, when we put restrictions on it, or when we force people to try to give equal time to other viewpoints, which may or may not be valid, you start to skew the marketplace.
Yes.
I believe in a complete, free, open marketplace. Let people discuss this stuff, knowing that in the end, truth will come out.
Yeah, you don't want to bottleneck the flow of truth, in other words.
Exactly.
Okay, so I want to go back to Case for Christ, because the Lord has used that so powerfully in so many lives. You know, we see a lot of people here and recommend that people buy the book, and we recommend that people buy a copy for themselves, and we find that people then buy a second copy to give to somebody else. Yeah. And so I bet by now you've got one or two or 100 different testimonies of people who've been converted through your book.
Oh. It's the greatest joy. I'm an evangelist. I just want to see people come to faith. And it's the greatest joy of my life to get these emails and phone calls and letters from people who God has used my books in their life. And there's some funny stories. There was one guy who was an amateur astronomer, a skeptic, an atheist, who went to a bookstore in Chicago, in suburban Chicago, and to buy an astronomy magazine. And he picked up the magazine. He sat down at the bench to look at it. And he sat on something, and he pulled it out, and it was a copy of The Case for Christ. And he looked at it and said, I don't believe this junk, and he threw it aside. And he said later, he says, it's almost like a voice inside of me said, that was not there by accident.
Hmm.
And he picked up the book, he read it, he came to faith.
Oh, my
goodness. And he wrote this incredible letter to me. I actually brought him to my publisher for their 20th anniversary to tell his story. I had another guy who was drunk. He was a college student at spring break down in the beach in Florida, and he spent all night. He was up. He'd been drunk and partying, and dawn was coming, and he said, I just felt empty, and I knew I wanted to find God. I wanted to believe, but there's so many obstacles. You know, how can a loving God allow pain and suffering? How could God send people to hell? I just got all these, And he's thinking about this stuff as he's walking down the beach. And then he told me, he said, I saw something half buried in the sand right in front of me. And if I'd been 5 feet to the left or 5 feet to the right, I wouldn't have seen it. But I almost tripped over it, and I picked it up. And he said, it was a copy of your book, The Case for Faith, which deals with all those tough questions. And he read it, and he came to faith.
Wow.
So, and one of my favorite stories involves Evel Knievel, who lived a very immoral life.
No kidding.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my goodness. And he, one day in Florida, a year and a half ago, felt God talk to him on the inside. And he said to him, Robert, which is his real name, he said, Robert, I've saved you more times than you'll ever know. Now it's time for you to come to me through my son, Jesus.
Oh.
And he said, he was just flabbergasted. He said, well, I don't even know who Jesus is. I don't even understand any of that stuff. What? So he called, the only guy he knew was a Christian, was Frank Gifford, the sportscaster.
Yes.
And Frank said, look, read The Case for Christ. Get a copy of The Case for Christ. So Evel Knievel's wife went out and got him a copy of The Case for Christ. He read it. He came to faith. He called me, and we got to be friends. He had such a powerful testimony. Hundreds of people. When he was baptized and gave his testimony, I think it was 700 people came to faith.
Oh, my.
Unbelievable. This guy was on fire for Christ, and, of course, he died a few months later.
This is the first I've heard that. That
oh,
is
yeah.
fabulous.
Oh, my gosh. And he would call me. We talked about every 10 days. He lived in Florida, and I'm in California, so we never really met in person. But he would call me and ask me theological questions, and he'd talk about his life, and he talked about his regrets. And he said, if I'd only found Jesus earlier, if I'd only come to faith earlier, so much I want to do, so many people I want to tell about Jesus. And when he died, you know, on his tombstone, he had engraved, believe in Christ.
Wow.
Yeah, it's amazing. And, you know, it was fun to watch his life change. He started out, he was such a narcissistic, self-absorbed, drunken, gambling, immoral. I mean, oh my gosh, the stories he told me about his life just would curl your hair. And then to hear him, his love for Christ, in fact, right before he died, a men's magazine came to interview him about his life. And during the interview, Evel told them about Jesus and broke down and was weeping and told them about Christ and Christ's love for him and how his life has changed, and et cetera. And this is in an interview with a men's magazine that he just was really radically saved.
Wow. I wonder what the impact is on his son, who's sort of taken his mantle.
That's a good question. They were alienated before his death. And he told me, he said, you know, my son was the only person that ever really stood up to me.
Wow.
And so they had been alienated. I know his son spoke at his funeral, and I hope it has an impact. His daughter is a Christian, and her church had been praying for him for years.
Wow. Wow. Well, Lee,
you never know. Nobody's beyond redemption.
That's exactly right. With all of this activity and furor over your writings, you must be under the skeptical microscope of the academic world.
Yeah.
How do your books go over in that realm?
Well, pretty well, because I don't, kind of take the evidence and then puree it and then present it. I go out and interview credible scholars who have PhDs and who have studied this stuff for a lifetime, and ask them the tough questions, and ask them the follow-up questions.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not like, okay, here's a scholar, and his opinion is Jesus rose from the dead. No, here's a scholar. He's convinced Jesus rose from the dead. And by the way, here's 15 reasons why he believes it. And that allows the academic world to put that to the test and say, okay, is that a good case? Does it make sense? Does it hold water? And interestingly, what we're seeing right now that's a major trend in universities in America, and I don't claim any influence on this necessarily, but what's happening is we're seeing the new Christianization of the philosophy departments of major universities.
Huh.
In the philosophy world, Christianity is winning the day.
Huh, it's reverting back to old times.
Exactly, and it's very exciting. The number of very influential Christians in the academy, including the greatest philosopher of the 20th century, Alvin Plantinga of Notre Dame.
Uh-huh, yes.
The Christian.
Wow.
These people are making a huge difference, and I think that's a real exciting trend.
Tell us about secular audiences. How do they respond to your messages?
Well, it's been very interesting. Those that are willing to follow the evidence I've seen many come to faith. In fact, I did a book recently called The Case for the Real Jesus that kind of updates the case for Christ, and it's all new, but it looks at the evidence of concerning recent charges against Christianity and tries to answer those. But on that book tour, where I had a lot of secular people come and listen to me talk about the book, we had almost 1,000 people come to faith.
Oh,
because I, being an evangelist, you know, I had I had an altar call at my book tour.
Wow,
but,
wow.
So I think people that are like Anthony Flew, who say, you know what, I'm going to follow the evidence wherever it takes me, even if it's to a very uncomfortable conclusion.
Hmm.
Those are the people that are finding faith. Those who rule it out at the outset and who say, you know, it's impossible. The idea of God on its face is impossible. So I'm ruling it out. Obviously, are not going to find him.
Yes. Right. Lee, let me ask you one more question.
Sure.
You wrote a study guide, or at least you helped in it. I think you wrote it for Passion of the Christ, that movie. What was the impact of that movie? It was pretty phenomenal, wasn't it?
It was. It was. And especially, Skip, internationally. This thing in Europe, in the former Eastern Europe and so forth, was much bigger than it was in the United States even.
Hmm.
But yeah, that book and the movie. The movie didn't live up to its hype, but certainly the book especially, and even to an extent the movie, raised a lot of issues involving the faith. Probably one of the number one issues was whether or not Christianity and the idea of a resurrecting God was just stolen from earlier mythology.
Yes.
Which I deal with in my book, The Case for the Real Jesus. Just absolutely not true. And it raised a lot, as you know, a lot of falsehoods involving how the Bible was put together and so forth. And, you know, on the good side of it, again, I think it was part of the process that is causing a resurgence of Christian apologetics, and people are looking for answers. And I know many people came to faith because the Da Vinci Code raised questions. They got good answers. They found that Jesus is who he claimed to be and gave their lives to him.
Lee Strobel, you're a great asset to the kingdom of God. We thank God for you.
Oh, thank you, Skip. God bless you and what you're doing. Oh, man, I hear all the time about what God's doing through your ministry, so I'm very excited about
that. Well, thanks for taking the time to be here on The Connection.
Glad to do it.
God bless you.
You too.